today to have our pastor, who also has all these degrees behind his name, as our speaker today. I must say I was impressed when I saw this all in print. I didn't know what it meant, but I got it written out so I can explain it to you. Randall J. LaFond is the director of Talbot Services Driver's Intervention Program and Talbot Clinical Services Opiate Addiction Treatment Program. Over the last 35 years, he has worked as a counselor, clinical director, program director, and chief executive officer in numerous hospital and community-based treatment programs and agencies. He has managed both inpatient and outpatient addictions and psychiatric programs. He has served as the regional director of psychiatric and behavioral services for Mercy Health Partners, the director of behavioral connections of Wood County Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. He has also served as a trainer and consultant to business and industry, addressing a broad range of topics, including drug-free workplace, alcohol and drug testing, and overall organizational improvement. He is currently the pastor of St. James of Kansas, Ohio. Randy holds a Master of Arts degree from the University of Dayton, a Master of Divinity from St. Leonard's College, and a Master of Business Administration from Tiffin University. He is also a licensed independent chemical dependence counselor and a substance abuse professional. He is originally from Bay City, Michigan. He still roots for them. He began his career in behavioral health in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he has worked and lived in Northwest Ohio since 1990. He currently resides in Bowling Green, Ohio. Please welcome Randall LaFond.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. What I'll do is kind of make a big circle and come back. I think that Janet wanted us to be done by 3. Just kidding. Just wanted to see if I had your attention. The main focus of this morning, we'll talk a bit about the drug that is sort of on all of our consciousness and in our communities, and that's heroin. I'll do a little bit of introduction around that, and then we have some slides that talks about addiction in general, and then we'll come back and sort of see if there's any questions. So that's a bit of a circle that we're going to make. Now, I have avoided my temptation to put up all kinds of slides with all kinds of graphs and charts saying that this is a problem. It really is. I do a driver's intervention program, which is in the state of Ohio. If you get a DUI, you're caught drinking and driving, you either go to jail for 3 days or you go to an educational program for 3 days. And we do that. In the last year or so, I have started asking members of the class, and these are folks that go from 18 to, we got one guy in the program this weekend who's 75. The oldest we've had is 82. So we have this wide range of people. And I asked these folks, how many of you know someone that has an opiate addiction problem or a problem with opiate drugs? 60 to 70% of the class raised their hand. That number is going up. Ohio leads the nation in opiate overdose deaths. More than California, more than New York, more than Florida, more than any other state. We lose 8 people a day to opiate overdoses in the state of Ohio. In 1 6-day period in Cincinnati in November, there were 176 overdoses. And there was about 8 or 9 deaths in that period from that number. And you think to yourself, where the heck did this come from? Just kind of sailed in out of the blue. I mean, most of us, and we look around here, we're all white and we're in the country. And it's like, where did this come from? Because often, at least in many of our consciousness, to think about heroin, we thought, well, that was an inner city problem. That was a poverty problem. That, you know, I get the vision of somebody with a needle in an alley, and that was an inner city problem. And then all of a sudden you're reading the paper and there are people getting busted in Fostoria and Tiffin and people dying of overdoses. And, you know, if you're a dealer and you sell to someone and they die, boom, you know, that's aggravated homicide. So all of a sudden it's in our consciousness and we're looking, where the heck did this come from? Believe it or not, a lot of it has to do with a decision, and this is my opinion, and I've worked, the first time I started working in addiction was in 1978 in a treatment center in Cincinnati for street alcoholics. And I've worked inpatient and outpatient, worked in the jails and the prisons, you know, so I have kind of a vast array from being in the country to being in the city, working in hospitals, that type of stuff. So, you know, I've carried dead bodies out of places from people that died of overdoses or killed themselves or, you know, committed suicide, those types of things. And it's interesting to think that I think the current problem that we have began in the late 1990s and early 2000s with a decision that was made by the American Medical Association, the hospital associations, and the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. That was when, you know what the four vital signs are? Got any nurses here? Four vital signs? Temperature, heart rate, respiration, pulse, those types of things. Okay. They added a fifth vital sign. Pain.
What?
Pain.
Oh, pain.
Pain. P-A-I-N. How many of us, if you've been with a doctor, you go to the hospital, whatever, they say on a score of 1 to 10, where's your pain? I know I had surgery back in 2001, and I said I'm concerned about the pain. They said to me, don't worry, we got more drugs than you got pain. So they made pain a fifth vital sign. Now, if I take Steve's temperature, that is an objective measure. I know that the ordinary body temperature is 98.2, and if he's got a temperature of 101 or 101.5, I can pretty much, I mean, it's objective. If he's got a pulse and it's not 120 over 80, you know, he's running 190, 195 over 95, I'm saying you got high blood pressure. I mean, those are objective measures. Pain is a subjective measure. You know, somebody comes up and punches me and I go, oh man, that hurts, that's terrible. They come up and punch Steve, he says, don't do that. Stop it. Pain is a subjective measure. And there used to be, for a lot of the pain medications, the real powerful pain medications were used in palliative care or end-of-life care with hospice. They were only used for cancer survivors. Then all of a sudden, everybody had pain. And you start giving these medications. Now, we're talking about opiates, about heroin. Now, you start tracking back a bit about that, and I'll get back to the pain medication issue in a minute. But what is heroin? What is an opiate? It starts with an opium poppy. Opium is, and it's a pain medication, it has that sedative effect, that analgesic effect of taking away pain. Started with the opium poppy. Now, it used to be that a lot of these substances were naturally occurring, like cocaine was a part of the coca plant, marijuana part of the cannabis plant. Opium was the resin from the opium poppy. And opium was smoked. And then in 1856, there was an invention. There were two things that happened in the middle 1800s that changed the face of everything. There was an invention in 1856 called the hypodermic needle. And at the same time, chemists were finding out how to break down the chemical composition of these different substances. They found out how to isolate cocaine hydrochloride out of the coca plant. That's the white powder that people snort. They found out how to isolate that. They found out how to isolate and draw out, from a chemical perspective, morphine from opium. So morphine goes from opium to morphine. And they got the hypodermic needle, and then you got the Civil War. What do you got in the Civil War? All these people, all these vets with their arms and their legs blown off. So now it's like we've got a route of administration, IV with a needle, and we've got this very potent morphine, and we start giving it to people to relieve their pain, and all of a sudden people go, well, that's pretty nice. I like that feeling, that, oh man, I like that. And then after the Civil War, you have all these vets becoming addicts. Now, at that time, you could go into any pharmacy in the United States, you could buy a pound of cocaine, you could buy morphine, you could buy whatever. There was no regulation at all. You could just go in and buy it. So you've got this ongoing problem developing as a result of science in the late 1800s. Into the early 1900s, there was 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act, where you couldn't put drugs in food. Many of you have heard that Coca-Cola, the Coke in Coca-Cola, was actually cocaine. Absolutely. Because it was developed as an elixir for old people by a pharmacist in Atlanta. And that's, you know, people would consume that. In 1906, they said, no, you can't do that. They started to regulate. In fact, the first drug law in the United States was in San Francisco, and it targeted the Chinese railroad workers because they were the ones smoking opium that they brought with them from China. That was the first drug law in 1887. Then you start having the Pure Food and Drug Act. 1914, you have the Harrison Narcotic Act. It was actually a tax act, where they began to tax pharmacists and began the whole prescription process. It wasn't until 1937 that marijuana became illegal with the Marijuana Reform Act of 1937. So he had this whole development. But often, you know, the political establishment is always trying to catch up to the reality of what's going on with the community. Morphine came from opium. They began to see all this morphine addiction. Then they found a drug that they said was a cure for morphine addiction. That was heroin. It was originally put in cough syrup because it would help take care of your cough. You know, so you have all these different levels of things where people are trying stuff and it just doesn't seem to be working very well. Now, you know, for a long time, and back even when I was in my early days of working within alcohol drug treatment, I didn't see a lot of heroin addiction at all. You know, when I started in 78, early 80s, working in treatment programs, you know, people that were coming into treatment were 45-year-old white guys with an alcohol problem. Then by the mid-late 80s, you saw a lot of cocaine coming in and a lot more people. You know, with the women's movement, we had the March on Washington, the Women's March on Washington, and those types of things going on. Well, equal opportunity means equal addiction as well. There used to be a time when, you know, you didn't really, because from a sociological perspective, it was not okay for women to be drunk and crazy in public. So usually a lot of the women that I saw in treatment in the early days, their issue was prescription medication. Valium was a benzodiazepine. The barbiturates, sometimes the amphetamines, those were the prescription medications is what we saw more and more of a problem on early on. But now it's an equal opportunity issue, you know. And in fact, most of the people, because right now we have 60, 65 people that we're treating for opiate addiction, and a majority of them started making the circle back to the change in the healthcare laws with prescription medications. What happens is, and this is a generalized scenario, I'm in an accident, I have a fall, I break a bone, I have a problem, I have a back surgery, I have something, and they prescribe me medications. Percocets, Percodan, Oxycontin, Oxycodone. They used to talk about Oxycontin as hillbilly heroin. It was used to treat black lung disease down in Appalachia. And then they just began, you know, this whole thing with medication, and there wasn't much regulation. Down in Portsmouth, Kentucky, Portsmouth, Ohio, became known as a pill mill. People would come from all over the United States to Portsmouth, Ohio, because they could get unlimited quantities of Oxycontin and Percocets and whatever. They would take them back and sell them. And you just had this boom, this big explosion around prescription medications. Now, here's the problem. I'm out. I have a bad leg, a bad knee. I have a problem. I start taking medications. And the fallacy or the thought was, well, this is prescribed by a doctor, so it can't possibly be addicted. Can't possibly have a problem. Because my doctor prescribed it. The effective window, in other words, how long a pain medication works for chronic pain. And sometimes we do need pain medication for chronic pain, absolutely. The effective window is 4 months. Then we know there are people that are prescribed it years and years and years. And what happens is this. The effectiveness of the pain starts going down, so you start using more and more of the medication. This gap then is filled in with the addiction. We'll talk a little bit about what addiction is in a minute. So they become addicted to this pain medication, and then they go to the doctor, and the doctors, the medical community is becoming more and more aware of the misuse of prescription pain medication, and they say, okay, Steve, well, you know, we're going to cut you off. Steve's been on pain medication for over a year, year and a half, 2 years. And all of a sudden they say, you're done. And so Steve goes to the street and starts buying pain medication off the street. Now if you have, like they call them an Oxy 80, an 80 milligram Oxycontin, usually you can figure out the cost of one of these pills by just a dollar per milligram. If you got an Oxy 80, that's $80. If you got a 40, that's $40. You just sell them on the street. That discussion brings a lot of us back to our medicine chests that we have in our homes. How many of us, you go to the dentist, you have something, you get, and you put your medication in the medicine chest. And you're thinking to yourself, well, maybe one day I'll need that. Strain my back or have something, I'll use that medication. Do not think for a minute, and it has happened to someone in this church, I'm sure of it, someone has gone in and looked in your medicine cabinet to see what you got in there when they're in your bathroom. And they find your pain medication. And they look at the date, and they realize they can take a couple out of there. Now, if I take two or three Oxy 80s out of somebody's prescription, all of a sudden, you know, I've got a couple $100 that I can sell on the street. So that's not out of the realm of possibility that people are get this issue. They may get it legitimately. Then they're cut off for their medication. Then somebody says to them in this circle of people that they're associating with, hey, I got something for you that'll take away the pain just as well as that what you're on, and it's cheaper. Because heroin is not expensive at all. You know? And all of a sudden they're off to the races. And they're snorting it, or they're running it IV, or they're smoking it. And the majority, 90% plus, 95% of the people that we're working with now are white. Equal amount men and women. And it's no longer an inner city problem. It is really expanded into our communities, into where we're at out here. That's sort of the introduction. Took half my time to do the introduction, right? But what I want to talk about is addiction in general, to give us an idea of what we're looking at. And it's all about the brain. You know, it is an alteration of the neurobiology of your brain. And you think about the brain, it has a very limited way of responding. It includes all of your life, the whole of your life. The way you think, your cognitive processes, the way you feel, your emotions, your mood, and your motivation, and your body function. Your body temperature, your heart rate, your sleep patterns, your eating patterns, all of those body functions. That's what the brain controls. And you put a substance into your brain that alters that function. And that substance, we're talking about opiates, about heroin, both naturally occurring, like opium, derivatives of that opium, like morphine and heroin. Then you also have the synthetic, and we'll talk later about one of the drugs that you may have heard about, fentanyl or carfentanil. We'll talk a bit about that later on. Those are synthetic opiates that are produced. That, I think, fentanyl and carfentanil, fentanyl particularly, is like 100 times stronger than morphine. And they cut the heroin with it. And the really demented thing about this, I have people that die of overdoses from that combination of fentanyl and heroin. And people hear that they died from it, and they want to know where they got the drug. Because they want to get that. They want to get that. Because they know that's good stuff. You can't make this stuff up, right? Okay, your brain has a very limited way of responding. Now, I got to give an environmental correction on this next series of slides. Oh, not that one. There will be that in just a minute. But look at this thing about brain disease. An altered brain, as I mentioned, you can change the neurobiology of your brain, but addiction isn't the only way that can be changed. Mental illness. There are a lot of people that are bipolar, they have depression, they have chronic anxiety, they have a thought disorder like schizophrenia or paranoid schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder. That's a naturally occurring imbalance of the neurobiology of your brain. And that impacts the way you think, the way you feel, the way your body functions. You don't have to have any addiction to have that going on. We have a lot of people that have mental health issues. Addiction. Chronic pain, you know, chronic pain alters the neurobiology of your brain. You can have one of these, or you can have two or three or all four of these. The other one I want to talk about is trauma. Often when we think trauma, most of us nowadays are thinking PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, survivors from World War II, Afghanistan, Vietnam, Iraq, you know. But the people that I see in terms of trauma, it's usually sexual trauma, physical trauma. You know, the women that I see, you start going back in their lives. You know, one young lady, she's got 5 children, separated from them, and has been for quite a while, has both mental illness and addiction issues. And I said, well, how old were you when you first started smoking marijuana? 12. How old were you when you first did cocaine? 12. How old were you when you, you know, began to drink in large quantities? 12. How old were you when you first did heroin? 12. So what happened when you were 12? She was raped by her mother's boyfriend. And then her mother said, you whore, why did you do that? To her, to the 12-year-old. And she's been high ever since. You know. And the consistent thing that I'm seeing with people that I work with is that most of them have 2 things going on in their life. Number one, they have a very profound trauma history. And number two, they have no spiritual life. You know, they don't have any way to deal with that trauma. They don't have any way to deal with the guilt and shame. They don't have any way to work and forgiving themselves and addressing it. And what, you know, what they have learned is, if I do a drink or a drug, it takes away the pain. I just want the pain to stop. Just want the pain to stop. And, you know, when you start looking at all of these, they will cause distortions. And if you look at the little fine print, you know, if you have your brain controlling the way your body works, the way your mind works, and the way your emotions work, and you have some of these things going on, if not all of them, look what happens. You have a distortion of thought, a distortion of body function, a distortion of mood and motivation. That then distorts your social environment. If you have or live with someone that has an addiction problem, you're held hostage. I mean, your family is just crazy, your environment. Because everything that you have come to learn about predictability and about natural human interaction goes out the door and down the toilet. And there is that distortion of the social environment. And it is very, very painful. Probably as we look around, we've got about 20 people in this room. About 25 to 30% of us grew up in a chemically dependent family, which meant that we had either a father or a mother or a brother or sister who had an alcohol or drug problem. And when you live within that family, it is very painful because you can't count on anything making sense, because it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. So, you know, you look at a slide like this and you see chronic pain, addiction, trauma, mental illness, these distortions, all of that is a result of brain chemistry. But you know what? It all comes down to the person, doesn't it? We can look at a slide like that and say, oh, okay, I get it. But what about me? You know, my life, if I have an addiction or a mental health issue, or if I'm a trauma survivor, or I'm dealing with chronic pain, how is that going to impact the way that I relate with you guys? How is that going to relate the way I interface with work, or with my wife, or children, or, you know, how is that going to impact? And it's going to make it nuts. It's going to be absolutely nuts. And there's only one reason why someone with an alcohol or drug problem quits that lifestyle. And that's that it's too painful to continue. It's just too painful. In the community known as Alcoholics Anonymous, they will use a little saying. They'll say, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Is it just too painful to continue? If it is too painful to continue, then you quit. Then you start to seek help. Now, 80% of the people that seek help and get into treatment, even though it might take a while, they're successful. But the majority of people that have the disease of addiction die from the disease, because it is a fatal brain disease. You know, it kills people. Problem is, it takes them a bit at a time. And it takes their spirituality first. And then it starts to take their self-respect. And then it starts to take their family and their friends. Now, they might end up dying of an auto accident or a fire or a fall or a homicide or a suicide or a drowning or whatever. And that doesn't get reported by the coroner as an alcohol or drug-related death. But it certainly is if you peel the onion back far enough. But in the midst of all of this, there's always a person. There's always a human being. And there's a family. And there's a spouse. And there's a child or a grandchild. Now, you know, again, sort of in the midst of that, why should we be concerned? Well, cognitive thought, your abstract thought, your executive function, reaction time, spatial, and all of that, you know, your entire ability to put your thought process together. If that's short-circuited, you're not going to be making good decisions, are you? You know, what were you thinking? They weren't. Gone. Emotions, mood, motivation, feeling. You know, the motivation and the mood and the feeling is about getting the drug, using the drug, and recovering from the drug, and then trying to figure out how to do it again. Now, this is the part where I said I have to have a correction on this, because Jenny informed me that a cucumber, or a pickle becomes a cucumber, not the other way around. Well, see, I have put this presentation together for city people. They think that pickles come from cucumbers. Cucumber, the little green thing in the garden, right? You put it in, it is pickled, and then it comes out in a jar. But Jenny said, no, no. They start out as a cucumber in the garden, and then they, or a pickle, and then they grow into a cucumber. Okay. Understood. I stand corrected. However, this is a presentation not for people that have gardens or master gardening. These are people that go to Kroger's and see that there's this green thing in a jar that looks like a pickle, and if they went to the garden, it started out as a cucumber. That's the correction. Not every cucumber becomes a pickle, using the analogy I just explained. But once you become a pickle, there's no going back to being a cucumber. It's a one-way street. Whatever you talk about it in the beginning, the green thing in the garden, by the time it ends up in the jar, that is a whole process. And it is a one-way street. There is no going back. Okay? If you have altered the neurobiology of your brain, and people are often surprised by this, but it's, you know, why do we drink too much? Why do people smoke weed? Why do they get high? Why do they do any of this in the beginning? Because it feels good. There's nothing naturally occurring in the world that will give us the same kind of buzz. The same kind of, ah, man, that feels good. I like that. That turns off the pain for a minute. That alleviates the boredom. Whatever it might be. Whatever the reason. That buzz is an alteration of the neurobiology of your brain. That's where the buzz comes from. But if you do that frequently enough, over a long enough period of time, you can permanently alter your brain chemistry. That's what addiction is. The permanent and irreversible altering of the neurobiology of your brain. You have rewired it. And that is a one-time rewiring. It does not go back, snap back into place like a rubber band. So there's the transition. Jenny, that it's exactly the opposite. But we're talking about the stuff in the jar on the other end. Okay. Now, when we look at use, abuse, or addiction, there's a word in Greek, diagnosis. We've heard that word. If you go to the doctor and you get a diagnosis, basically they tell you what's wrong. It comes from a combination of two words, diag, which means to cut, and gnosis, which means knowledge. So a diagnosis is cutting through knowledge. If I give you a diagnosis, I basically tell you what's wrong. That might be my auto mechanic who's listening to, you know, my car engine or look at the little light and say, well, you know, your fuel injectors are bad or you got a bad lifter, you got this, or that's a diagnosis. So depending on where you are in that transition, you look at all of that and you can give a diagnosis. Is this use? Is this abuse or high risk use or abuse? Or is this addiction? So there's stages of all of this. Not everyone that uses becomes an addict or an alcoholic. In fact, relatively small numbers. People that use, and even use or try the harder drugs, actually become addicted. You know? There's another word in Greek, prognosis, which means end knowledge. I'll give you a diagnosis, but what's the prognosis? You know, your diagnosis is you have cancer. Prognosis is you better get your stuff in line. You got about 6 months. That's an end knowledge. Well, we know in terms of a diagnosis with, because, you know, this addiction thing, since the early 50s, I think 1950, so 65 years, the American Medical Association has listed addiction as a disease process. And we as a community often still think, well, no, it isn't. It's just that, you know, if they would just pull themselves up by their bootstraps, if they just tried harder, you know, Nancy Reagan's just say no. Not if you've altered the neurobiology of your brain, saying no doesn't have anything to do with that. Because that is an objective type thing. And, you know, on what day does that little green thing from your garden stop being a little green thing and become a pickle in a jar? On what day does that happen? We're hard-pressed to say on what day. The determining factor is how long did it stew in the juice, right? How long was it in the jar with the pickling spice? How long did that take? And on what day? It's a process. Same with addiction. It's a process. And it takes time. You know, the process of addiction to alcohol might take 10, 15, 20 years. Process of addiction to crack cocaine can take 4 weeks. Because of different type of drug, different piece of the brain that's impacted, and a different delivery system. A different delivery system. How does it get into your system? How does it get into your body and ultimately to your brain? So let's look at some of these drugs that we're talking about. These are drugs that are mood altering. Depressants, they take you down. Alcohol is a depressant. Barbiturates, benzodiazepines like Valium, Xanax, Ativan. You know, you even look at how many people have prescriptions of Xanax for anxiety. The addictive dose of Xanax is 1.5 milligrams over 30 days. And yet you got people that are on Xanax for years and years and years. They try to stop that medication and all of a sudden the symptoms come roaring back and they feel like they want to jump out of their skin. You know, well that's the addiction at work. Again, it's the altered neurobiology of your brain. So depressants, stimulant drugs, amphetamine, sometimes known as speed, crystal meth, that used to be a big thing that people cooked crystal meth out in the country. They'd rob the farmers to get the anhydrous ammonia that they would use in terms of the fertilizer and that type of thing. I mean, I don't know exactly how you do this, but they call it cooking crystal meth, and it is a nasty process. The byproducts of that, the chemicals, it's just really, really nasty. Ecstasy, which is often a club drug that had been really big in the 80s and early 90s and is starting to come back. Methyldiethylene methamphetamine, it is a speed. Ice is the smokable form. Now, cocaine is a stimulant. That's the one we're probably more familiar with. Crack is the smokable form of cocaine. And it comes from the little noise it makes when it's burned. It kind of makes a cracking sound. That's where the word came from. So crack is a type of the smokable form of cocaine. Ice is the smokable form of crystal meth. Hallucinogens like LSD, mescaline or peyote, haven't seen a whole lot of that around much anymore. And then you have the opiate painkillers like we've been talking about. Heroin, morphine, oxycodone, oxycontin, Percodan, Percocets, fentanyl, carfentanil, Demerol, Tylenol 3s, codeine. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, are pain medications. And we just, these are the things, you know, go home and look in your medicine cabinet. Be aware of what you got in there. Because, you know, grandpas and grandmas, just because you suspect that your grandchild may be never one to use an illicit drug, it may well be true, but you know, if they need a little bit of money, they know they can probably get some of that medication and sell it at school. And you think, oh, not at Lakota. You know. Not in Tiffin, not in Fort Astoria, not with the Redmond. Oh yeah. Let me tell you. Because I see it all the time. Sedative hypnotics like marijuana and hashish. Believe it or not, the percentage of people that get addicted to marijuana are less than alcohol. I'm not in favor of legalization of marijuana necessarily, especially recreationally, only because it makes it pretty available and gives permission, and we have all these crazy people out on the road driving drunk now. I don't want more people out there driving under the influence, you know. Gets kind of scary. So, I mean, that's in large part why I'm not in favor of it. But here's the deal. You know, no crooked thought without a crooked molecule. It's all about altered brain chemistry. You know, addiction is about altered brain chemistry. How much and how often of what do you do and put it in your system? That's what it's all dependent on. And that gets translated out into the larger world as crazy thoughts, crazy emotions and feelings, and crazy, just craziness. Just. So, you know, what happens, and this is key, is that over time the substance can hijack the brain's reward and survival systems. Pleasure and reward. I mean, as human beings, we will do nothing for free. We've got to be paid off. Our brain knows that. We're not conscious of it, but our brain is always paying us off. When we put those substances into our brain, it hijacks that system, and the impact of it, the feeling, the, oh man, feeling is so much of a rush that there's nothing naturally occurring in our natural system that will replace it. Nothing. And that's all dependent on quantity, frequency. How much and how often of what do you use? What's the purity? What type of substance? And how pure is it? And then the route of administration. How do you get it into your body? Look at cocaine for a second, and you know, we've all sort of watched the Miami Vices or whatever, and you know, say hello to my little friend things, you know. You got this white powder and you're snorting it up your nose. Well, that's cocaine hydrochloride, that's a salt. It goes into your nose, it goes into your sinuses, and then it gets into your bloodstream, and it goes to your heart, and it gets pumped to your lungs, and it goes back to your heart, and eventually it gets to your brain. And you get that all feeling. Now, what if you take that white powder and you mix it up with water? You put it in a syringe and you run it into your arm. Now the purity is the same of those two. But the route of administration has changed. Now you've shot it into your arm. Now how it gets the amount and the distribution system is now sped up. So it gets to your brain a whole lot quicker. What about crack, the smokable form of cocaine? They have, you know, the powdered cocaine, the white is a salt. The temperature on that is too high to burn and to smoke. So they have to chemically change it from a salt to a base. Now, any 13-year-old with a microwave can make crack cocaine out of the powdered cocaine. How many of you remember the day when you couldn't buy a single beer in carryout? You always had to buy a 6-pack or a 12-pack. You couldn't go in and buy a single beer. Then the manufacturers and the distributors, because it was a law, you couldn't. It was a package law. At least it wasn't Michigan. I think probably in Ohio too. You just couldn't go in and buy a single beer. Well, then they said, there are people that they don't have enough. They don't have $2-2.5 or whatever it was in those days to buy a 6-pack. But they've got 75 cents to buy a single beer. So they broke it down into unit doses. Now, usually the powdered cocaine was sold in grams. A gram is about the size of a pack of the Sweet and Low. That was about $80 to $100. Well, they realized that, there were people that did not have $80 to $100 to buy that much cocaine. But if they chemically changed it from that powder to a base, now you have a little rock, and you've got $10 or $20 to buy a rock of cocaine. So they changed the delivery system. Now look at how it gets into your system. Put it in a pipe and you hit it, goes into your lungs, into your brain. It might take 3, 5, 7 minutes after you snort it to get to your brain. You hit the pipe and the top of your head blows off in about 3 seconds. You want to know how addictive a drug is? Just ask yourself, how high do you get how quick? If you get really, really high, really, really quick, it's really, really addictive. Those people that are drinkers, think about how long it takes you to get really drunk. Well, if you're chugging down a bottle of straight Jack Daniels, it can happen fairly quickly. But for a lot of people, you can spend most of the evening drinking and you just got a nice buzz. Takes a while. So that's why when you look at the addictive time it takes for alcohol, sometimes that's longer than some of the other drugs. But still, the pathways are all the same. How much and how often are you doing what, and to what extent are you altering the neurobiology of your brain? Quantity, frequency, how much and how often. Type and purity of the drug, how addictive is the substance, how pure is it, and route of administration. It's almost laughable. If it wasn't, it'd be laughable if it wasn't so sad that people have no idea what they're buying. And, Lord have mercy on my speech here, but it's like, well, what do you got there? What's good shit? Okay. Where'd you get it? Oh, my cousin got it from some guy named Juan in Bogota. What is it? It's white powder and it gets you high. You don't know what it is. There's no quality control on street drugs. At least if you have a pill, you know what it is. You can tell by the marking. You can go online. You can figure it out. But so many folks that we work with and I work with, they have no idea what it is. Talked to a woman the other day. She was 38 years old the first time she used heroin. Within a year, she was arrested for aggravated robbery, which means she used a gun. She spent 3 years in prison. She got out in April of last year. She started using again in May. She woke up in bed with her boyfriend. He was dead. They used the night before and he overdosed. She has continued to use all that time, and only now, in the middle of January, is saying maybe it's time to stop. You would think, that gives you an idea of how powerful this is. You used in less than a year, you spend 3 years in prison, you get out, you're out 1 month, and you wake up dead in bed with your significant other. He dies of an overdose, and you continue to use for the next seven and a half, 8 months. And finally, why is it that she's finally calling to get into treatment? Because it's too painful to continue. It's just too painful. And again, we're talking about hijacking the reward and security center of the brain. Let's use a couple examples here, like mood center. What you got is that often people will begin, if you look on the very top, you have euphoria, dysphoria, and your normal balance. Euphoria is feeling as high as you can. Dysphoria is feeling as low as you can. Most of us are in the middle. When we use, when we drink, when we use some substance, we catch a little buzz, we want to feel good, and then we want to come down. X, Y, kind of a curve. But then for some people, they go ahead and you know what? They go ahead and use, but they come down. Maybe they have a hangover. Now they're down into that kind of a negative area. They feel this is kind of crappy. This is kind of bad. Huh? Then what happens is this. They're feeling miserable most of the time. Unless they go ahead and use. But you know what? They don't get as high as they used to. And then eventually you got this. You got people that are just using every day just to try to feel normal. And if we haven't been in this cycle or we haven't worked with people, this doesn't make any sense to us. Because most of us work up every day feeling normal for free. And now you've got people paying $80, $100, $120, $200 a day just to feel normal. Especially with opiates, because if they stop using them within 4 to 6 to 8 to 12 hours, they're going to start going into withdrawal. Now, withdrawal from heroin will not kill you. It's kind of like the worst case of the flu you ever had on steroids. Withdrawal from alcohol will kill you. And often we don't take that. We don't take that too seriously. But we've got all of these people here. And this is true with alcohol as well. You know, one of the things that I learned used to talk about, HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. As things to be worried about. I always tell people now, bored. You've got a lot of people that they're just bored. They don't like the feeling of being bored. So they get high, so they don't have to feel bored. And we're in this McDonald's drive-through culture. I'll have a Big Mac and Coke, order fries, and 10 years of recovery. Doesn't work that way. The reward system. These are survival mechanisms. These are all the things that we do in order to survive as a species. I can't overemphasize this one slide. I mean, we can spend days talking about this. But, you know, have you ever eaten your favorite meal? You're really hungry and you have that favorite meal and you push back from the table and you go, oh man, that was good. Whew! And you have that feeling. That's neurotransmitters in your brain releasing dopamine that gives you that ah feeling. Why do we want the ah feeling? So we go back and we keep on eating. That we eat more. Because our body knows that if we don't eat, we die. You know, people that become anorexic or have those types of eating disorders, they just don't eat and they end up dying. I don't have that problem. You know, I like the ah feeling of a good burger or spaghetti or chicken or, you know, just that, oh man, that feels good. How about feed? Providing for your children. That is a survival. We're rewarded for doing that. You can have your little ones that drive you crazy. But you put that grandchild in bed or that child in bed, you pull the covers up and you look at them and you go, I love you. You know? And that, oh man, mom's that ah feeling. That is your brain rewarding you for caring for the young. Because if we didn't, as a species, care for the young, they would die. Our brain rewards us for that. Feeling, emotion, accomplishment. You know, you go out and you fix the lawnmower. And you go, yeah, that's pretty cool. You figure out how to use the computer. You go to work. You do whatever. Accomplishment. Feeling. You know, that's so important in terms of our lives. To have purpose and meaning in our life. Flirt. Basically procreation. Making love. Why do we do that? We like the cookie. We like the feeling. And if people didn't do that, we wouldn't have children. If we didn't have children, we would die out within just a matter of generations as a species. Our brain rewards us. Then we've got fight, flight, and freeze. These are all survival mechanisms. Somebody jumps out at you, you're going to fight them, you're going to run from them, or you're going to hide from them. You don't even have to think about it. All of those things are meant to give us life. And to protect life and to continue life. You put a drug into your brain, these all get short-circuited. I work with people, and you know, you'll look at folks and you'll say, how could a mother treat their child? How could they leave that baby in a crack house? How could that mother or father not treat that, you know, take care and pay the rent? How can that dad go to the bar and spend all their money and not pay the rent? You know what? Because these things are all short-circuited. People stop eating. They stop caring for their young. They stop looking at accomplishment or jobs or whatever. You know, they lose interest in intimacy. They get anxious, they get paranoid, and they get depressed. Now there's a good time. I don't eat. I don't take care of my business. I don't stay in relationship. I have no purpose in life. I have emotional and mental issues. I'm angry, I'm paranoid, and I'm depressed. And the downside of that is then we think that in order to accomplish, get over that, I'll use more. And it becomes, you know, Alice down the rabbit hole, because it just begins to spin out of control. Because it doesn't get better, it only gets worse. Here are things that we'll look for in addiction: compulsive use, loss of control, and using in the face of adverse consequences. People that have issues with addiction, no matter what the drug is, they will compulsively use. You know, it's not a matter of choice, because it's hijacked that whole reward system, and now that is where they find the reward, their purpose in life, their child, their, all the way down the line of that. You lose control. You lose predictability. You know, someone says, well, Steve, would you like to, Steve says to me, Randy, would you like to stop after work and have a beer? I'm like, yeah, I'll stop. I'll have a beer. We stop. I'm looking at my watch. I know I got to be home by 7. It's about 5:15. I know I got to be home by 7 because I got to take my kid to a school thing. We stop for a beer. If I got this going on, I can't predict what's going to happen once I start drinking. He has 2 beers and leaves and goes home. The next thing I know, I'm closing the bar at 2. My kid has long since been dusted off, and I've spent my entire check. Because once I start drinking or using, I can't predict what's going to happen. You lose predictability. I might be able to have 1 or 2 beers, but once I start, I don't know if I'm going to have 1 or 2 or if I'm going to close it up, because I just don't know. You know, if you look at a light switch, you got a light switch on off, or a rheostat, you dial down, you dial up. Most people got a rheostat when it comes to that kind of thing. You can choose to drink more or you can choose to drink less. People in this situation, they got an on off switch. If they're on, they're on. And they lose predictability. Using in the face of adverse consequences, they keep on using even though bad stuff happens. You get DUIs, you lose your driver's license, you have problems at home, your spouse is threatening to leave you, and you keep drinking. Most of us would say that's a bad idea. Not these folks, because they don't have that on-off switch. They're like rheostat. They can just, if they're on, they're on. And that is, unfortunately, to the detriment of all those people around him. This is what it's not. Addiction is not just a moral weakness. No, well, they can't tell right from wrong. It's not just a bad habit. It's not mental illness. Mental illness can be included in it, but it is separate from that. It's not just a character weakness. It's not just a response to life pressures, or it's not just a temporary lapse of control. They'll snap out of it. All of those things may be a part of it, and that's why when we look at it, these seem to make sense to us. But it is that alteration, permanent alteration of the neurobiology of the brain. It is a one-way track. It does impact the way you think, the way you feel, the way your body functions, and it impacts everybody around you. And it's not dependent on what kind of person you are. It's an equal opportunity disease. Male, female, rich, poor, black, white, doesn't matter. We are born with genetic risk levels. There are genetic factors in this. If you come from a family where a father, mother, brother, sister had an issue with addiction, you've got about a 25% more of a chance than the average folks to have that same kind of issue. Does it mean it's going to happen? No. It just means that if I have high blood pressure and diabetes running in my family, I should be aware of that and just keep an eye on it. If you have addiction running in your family, you've got to keep an eye on it. Each person reacts differently. You can choose to use. You can choose to drink or whatever. What you can't choose is your body's reaction. You know, you cannot control your body's reaction. So what kind of a person you are and why you choose to use is not as important as how much and how often. That's what it boils down to. How much and how often do you use or do you drink? It's lifestyle. You know, the hardest part is for many of us to think about it. You know, I can have someone that has a heart attack or has cancer or whatever. I give them, you know, I understand that. They can get help, whatever. Somebody has an addiction problem, I automatically make an assumption they're a bad person. No, they're not. But a lot of their behavior gets translated out, and it's very destructive, and I look at the behavior and make a judgment based on that behavior. Now, you're not responsible for your disease process, but you are responsible for your recovery. There's a difference. You know, you can choose to drink or use. You can't choose your body's reaction. And you can't control an out-of-control biological process. Many of us have had diarrhea in our life. Have you ever tried to overcome diarrhea with willpower? Doesn't work well, does it? You cannot control an out-of-control biological process with willpower. It won't work. That's what we have here. An out-of-control biological process. We're not responsible for that out-of-control process. Yeah, I did choose to drink or to use. I didn't choose what happened to my body. But now that I'm aware of it, I am responsible for my recovery. Substance abuse is a behavior. You know, just drinking too much, getting crazy, doing weird things. Well, I was just drunk when I did that. Nah, that's not a pass. That's a behavior. We are all responsible for our behavior. Addiction is a disease. We're not responsible for the disease. We are responsible for the behavior, or for the recovery. Abuse, which is part of that early on in that continuum, that's a behavior. We are all responsible for our behavior. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
So, I've heard about being genetically predisposed to addiction and things like that, but it sounds like it really is a heredity and versus environment kind of argument, and that both things really can play a part. So I guess I was just curious if we're saying that somebody could genetically be predisposed to be an addict, has that ever been studied in, for example, like a family where a child was separated from their family, wasn't exposed to the addictive environment that maybe a parent was going through, but that child still somehow developed an addiction due to genetics as opposed to environment?
Excellent question. And the answer to that is yes. They've done significant studies in really three different countries, Denmark, Sweden, and the United States. In large part, they did adoption studies. And they chose those countries in large part because they have really good adoption records. And what they did is they looked at children who their genetic parents had no addiction, no substance abuse. They were adopted into families that where there was addiction. So we've got the genetics, and then we got the environment. So these are clear genetics. They go into a family where there is addiction present. In that, where now we were looking at the environment, there didn't seem to be any difference in terms of addiction rates between in that situation. But what they found was if you take a child that grew up in an addictive family, was born in an addictive family, and then was raised in a family with no drinking, no addiction, they were four times more likely to develop a problem than someone else. So that's where they come up with that four time the difference. Now they also did studies on you're trying to figure out is this what role does genetics play and they looked at let's look at people that have the same genetic stuff. Now there's one group of human beings that have the same the same stuff. They're identical twins. Okay, they have the same genetics. So they wanted to look at concordance rates or the rate of a likeness. And if it were 100% genetics, then you would expect that, you know, if I'm a twin and I have blonde hair and blue eyes, and my identical twin has blonde hair and blue eyes, that's a 100% concordance rate, 100% transfer rate. So if it were 100% genetically controlled, if one twin had addiction, you would expect to see the other twin as well. What they found was that in that case, 50%. What's the difference between the two different choices? You know, even though they had the same genetic stuff, only half of the twins, the identical twins, if one became addicted, the other became addicted as well. That says they really had different choices. So is there a genetic predisposition? Yes, there is. Does that mean that you're doomed to that life? No, it doesn't. It all comes back to the choices. How much and how often of what? Now, you may be genetically predisposed, like I may be genetically predisposed to diabetes or heart disease or whatever. Now, I can manage that with diet and exercise and be aware of it and medication and whatever. But it's always good to know that, to be aware of it. Did that kind of answer what you're
saying? Yeah, very much.
You had methadone listed as one of the hypnotics, I think was what it was.
Opiate,
yeah. Okay. It's been considered a treatment. So where does that stand now?
Well, that is a treatment. Some of the medications, opiate-based medications that they will use to treat opiate addiction, methadone is one that's been around, you know, since the 60s. We're aware of that. The one that we work with is called Suboxone, buprenorphine. You may have heard of that medication. Basically and both of those medications have mood-altering effects, and they're opiates. And it's like, well, wait a minute, you're using an opiate to treat opiate addiction? Part of that is considered harm reduction. That, especially like methadone, people are coming, they're getting a dose on a daily basis. And some people do that for years. And does it have mood-altering effects? Yeah, but the thing is, with, you know, as a culture, as a society, as a medical community, we make a choice. Is it better to have this person medically regulated with methadone on a daily basis, or out breaking into your house, stealing your stuff to get enough possessions to sell to be able to support $100 or $200 a day drug habit? Now, the Suboxone, what happens is it's called an agonist. And in the brain, you have these opiate receptors. And these little suckers, they start yelling. And once you become, you know, it's a part, you don't even have to become addicted necessarily, but these guys are yelling for the drug. And if you don't put the drug in, you become really upset. You get diarrhea, it's called withdrawal. So you get really, really sick. And what happens is when you put the Suboxone medication in, it adheres to those opiate receptors, and you take it on a daily basis. And they're little films. They're 8 milligram films, two of them. So you've got 16 milligrams a day, once in the morning, once at night. And that keeps you from going into withdrawal, and it also knocks down the craving. And if you should use an opiate, it blocks the effects of it. Because you got so many of those receptors in your brain, that medication fills those receptors. Now, some people say, well, wait a minute, a drug is a drug. If you're still using that drug, isn't that, did that, you know, it's like, well, I got high blood pressure. I got to use medication to deal with my high blood pressure or my diabetes or, you know. Medication isn't necessarily bad. We got people all the time that they come in, and what they want to do from us is get a script so they can go sell it on the street. Because they can get $20 for one of those little scripts. They get, you know, two a day, 14 on a weekly basis. I'm selling that, you know, I got a couple, $200-$300 worth of Suboxone I'm selling on the street. Now, because it takes away the withdrawal, you've got people out there that are trying to buy that medication off the street. And we're hearing it all the time. People are buying it off the street. Because it helps with the withdrawal and whatever. And, you know, it is profoundly miserable. I mean, addiction is not a happy lifestyle. And, you know, people that are 13, 14 years old, you know, 15 years old, you know, when Kelsey's looking at her life, she's not saying, gee, you know, when I grow up, I want to be a heroin addict. You know, I mean, nobody does that. Nobody wants that lifestyle. And yet so many people end up there. And yeah, there are some medications that that treat that. Methadone is one. Suboxone, the buprenorphine is another. Naloxone may be something that you hear about in the news. Naloxone is a spray. And what that does is it stops the tragic end result of an opiate overdose. It impacts those neurotransmitters and it stops the overdose. So many people, especially if they're combining benzodiazepines with opium or with the opiate, with heroin. Remember to talk about body function? It just stops your heart, your respiration, turns it off like the lights. That's what an overdose is. You turn the light off, and it's usually respiration, heart rate related, combination of cocktail or an overdose. Fentanyl and carfentanil, as I mentioned, are very, very powerful. They're synthetic medications, and actually the fentanyl came out of the Demerol line. If any of you were ever in the hospital and you got a Demerol shot or you heard that term, that's an opiate. And then, you know, you synthetic.
Women, when they're pregnant, okay, and, you know, I think, you know, we've got crack babies and we also have those with alcohol problems. So is that basically because, you know, when they're using, in the formation of the brain of the child is affected?
Absolutely. And, you know, that the two that you mentioned, fetal alcohol syndrome and the crack cocaine, are really have a negative impact. And it has all to do with fetal brain development. And we do treat pregnant women in our program as well. One of the medications they use, they don't use Suboxone, it's called Subutex, which they use for pregnant women. But, you know, when these babies are going to be born, they've got to go into a high-risk neonatal situation, because when babies are born, they go into withdrawal. And you've got this little baby that now is going into withdrawal as a result of their mothers being addicted. And it's tragic. It's crazy. And they're underweight, low-weight birth babies. And yeah, I mean, for a woman to be pregnant, and we see it all the time, it's just the result. And it's intergenerational. I mean, I'm surprised at the number of people in our day and time that are, you know, 20s, 30s, early 40s. They don't have a high school education. You know, and they're trying to survive, and they got a $200 or $250 a day drug problem, you know, drug habit. I don't know about you guys, but I'm not going to be able to come up with $1,000 a week for my drug habit. I can't come up with that kind of money for my car payment. But we got them out there all the time, you know, that are and where are they getting it? You know, look at the crime stats. You know, they're going up. Yeah.
When people enter treatment, how much medical or psychological evaluation do they get? Because, you know, to make sure, is mental illness a part of it? Is ADHD a part of it? I mean, the picture we get from television shows and things is pretty much treatment is one size fits all. You know, like 12-step program or whatever it is, a lot of group therapy and things like that. So how much individualized assessment is there?
Well, that's an excellent question, because I think that for many years it was one size fits all, and they would do stuff. I know that back in the 80s and even early 90s, they would say, oh, well, you know, we'll work on your addiction problem, but we don't treat mental health, mental illness, so you've got to go over here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, chronic pain, well, we're not going to deal with that at all. And we never even address trauma. So that little slide, that four-phase trauma, you know. And part of it is, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You don't know. You have somebody coming in and they're presenting with just a boatload of problems. And it's like, well, let's start to unpack this. The first thing we know is that nothing's going to happen until you stop using. So let's get you free. And then I think that you're right on, is that one size does not fit all. There are some things that historically have worked. 12-step meetings have historically worked. Individual counseling, group sessions, they work. But, you know, I have one young woman that's working with me now. She's in her middle 30s. Spent 15 years in the sex trade in East Toledo. And just has a huge trauma history. And I've worked with her for over a year, and she's just now getting to a point of wanting to address that piece. Now, she has to address it, but she had to stop using first. And that's everything, because people will say, well, you know, I've stopped opiates. I'm not going to do my opiates anymore, but I'm still going to smoke weed and drink and do cocaine. And I say to him, if you're in love with Snow White, you're not going to settle for a date with one of the seven dwarfs. You know, I mean, you're just going to go back. You know, those other things will take you back. And you got to be drug-free, because then you can start to sort out. Now, because of the nature of addiction, you're going to have severe depression for the first year. You know. So is that a long-term case? Well, you got to be treating the depression along with the addiction, and then look at the trauma, and then try to find out if it's chronic. So it's all cross-related among those four. And unfortunately, the treatment programs have not been sophisticated enough to be able to deal with that effectively, in my opinion.
I can't help but I didn't realize that Ohio was the highest with the heroin addict, but it pretty correlates highly. Ohio, the state of Ohio, is very high for sex crimes and sex trafficking. Why don't we change our court systems and help? When can we start saying, okay, Ohio, let's make a difference?
They are saying that, and interestingly enough, I've sort of been this, bleeding heart liberal yellow dog Democrat all my life. I voted for John Kasich, first Republican I ever voted for. I voted for him in the Republican primary because he understands, and is willing to take that stand out there and expanding Medicaid to begin to get people help. You look at Sheriff Thorpe up in Lucas County. They're putting in drug courts. They've got this program of officers that work that now people that are having a drug overdose, they'll call the police because they know they got naloxone and they'll help them. They take them to, they have someone follow up with them at the hospital. Because often, what was it? The churches looked at his addiction as a sin. The law enforcement community looked at it as a crime. And the medical community, for the most part, ignored it. And it's the number three killer in the United States, after heart disease and cancer.
Well, I just wonder how many, I've learned something in that if your law enforcement and court systems don't know about drug abuse, which they surely don't, and sexual abuse, that's why Ohio's probably, but all over the country, but we need people like you to teach those small communities.
The governor and different folks in the law enforcement community, they're working real hard to play catch up on this. And they're saying things like, does it do any good to put people in prison? You can have someone that catches a drug charge and they put them in prison and they are there for 2-3 years and then they get out. Often we see them die immediately in getting out of prison. Because they go back and there's a whole thing of tolerance. Their ability to process is dropped. And they used to go and they used to use X amount. They go back out and they try to use X amount and it stops their heart and their respiration. And they end up dying. But actually, for the first time I'm able to say I'm kind of proud of what the political groups are doing in Ohio. The Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. The Governor's Office. A lot of community control. But where was it? Was it Sandusky or Wyandotte County where the sheriff got arrested for,
Sandusky.
Yeah. I mean, what was it? He was stealing prescription medications. He was an opiate addict. Buying them off the street, stealing them, getting them out of wherever. And it cost him his livelihood, cost him his job. That's a very high profile thing that all of us are aware of. And here, he's wearing orange and sitting in jail and his name is on the ballot for the next to be the sheriff. Well, he lost the election, but he lost the career. I'm not sure how that all got started with him, but it was probably some type of an injury. Started with pain medication and was able to function. And then it just starts spinning out of control. But that was an opiate addiction. Absolutely. Yes.
So rather than sit around and wait for politicians to figure out how to solve it, what can a community like St. James as a church do to help? I mean, it just feels like you're so powerless against something that has such a powerful influence, such a powerful negative influence on the community. And obviously addiction can start so much faster than you can solve it. So it's you're always going to be chasing it from behind. It feels like it's a moving target, and it spreads faster than you can fight it. What kind of resources are available to people that are in this room to do something to make a difference?
Well, you know, the number one unit of change is the family. You know, and parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, community members. You know, that's the number one unit of change. And I think that in the family, there's each of us individually. And we have to really honestly look at and evaluate our own alcohol drug use. We got to look at what's in our medicine chests. You know, what is in there? How long has it been in there? Does it need to be in there? You know, if you need pain medication, go to the doctor, get a script.
What do you do if you have pain meds that you don't use? Like, you don't want to just dump them down the toilet or that kind of thing. I mean,
they have collections of police department.
Yeah, a lot of them will have collection points that you can drop them off.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's sort of the political right response. But I think it really does start with each of us individually evaluating our own self and then looking at our families and then our church, our community, and to realize that it's not just a matter of this is something that happens in the city, because it isn't. I mean, it's in, you know, Tiffin and Heidelberg universities, you know, and, you know, I mean, addiction rates among senior citizens are huge. You know, those of us that are falling into that category.
I went to a informal speech about drug abuse, and the sheriff from San Diego County was there, and also a mental health person from the three counties, and they were talking about the fentanyl when they seize the medication at like a drug dealer's place. They have to be very careful because that fentanyl, if they accidentally even inhale it, it can kill them instantly. And that carfentanil? That is a tranquilizer for an elephant.
Yeah. I was at a conference in Pittsburgh, and they said the youngest overdose fatality they had with opiates, with fentanyl, was a 5-year-old that accidentally stepped on their grandmother's fentanyl patch. Jeez. And it killed them.
So they have to handle it very carefully so that they don't accidentally ingest it.
Yeah, and a lot of that is coming out of China. You know, I mean, we talk about Mexican cartels. I mean, and if we as a society are buying it, there's going to be people that are going to be selling it. You know?
Well, getting back to my question a little bit earlier, do you have any success stories that you can share about any strategies that have been used to help people overcome it, or people that have come out of it, and maybe the role that a church played in their life in helping, or anything like that? Maybe those stories are rare, and that's unfortunate. But
well, I think that in large part, most of the folks that I see have no spiritual background or tradition.
Right.
In large part because they don't feel welcome. They don't feel welcome. They feel judged. Because the churches have not been open to them because their lives are so dysfunctional and crazy. Now, success? Yeah, I've seen, you know, our little program has been open for, you know, it'll be 2 years in August. And we've seen some people that have come in that I wouldn't have given you a nickel for any type of positive life. Now, these folks, let me underscore, and I can't say this strongly enough, these folks live a lifestyle that we have no comprehension of. None. I mean, I've done this all my life, and I'm constantly surprised. I think to myself, I possibly can't hear this. I mean, I'm working with a young woman right now. She was 17 when she got pregnant. And her mom and dad were very displeased with her. And she came home, and they had moved. She came home, and now you've heard this, and you think, oh, you're kidding, right? You've got to be kidding. No. She came home, and her parents moved. In tears, she said, they even took the dog, and they left me. Come home from school, everything's gone. And then you just start rolling the tape forward in terms of that. And I've been working with her for 8 straight months. And she stopped the opiates. She's finally starting to get the cocaine out of her system and starting to get some of the marijuana is going down out of her system. Because we do drug screens all the time. And we can tell where these levels are. And this was a woman who lost everything in a fire and is living in a basement, has no employment, has, you know. You just look at, and it's just slowly starting to rebuild. That's why they call it recovery. Slowly began to rebuild. And a lot of stuff that I've taken for granted in my life, I just take it for granted. And folks lose everything. And how much of it can you get back? And we see it. I mean, we see, and not a lot, because probably half the people that come in our doors leave within 2 weeks. They don't want it. And probably about a quarter of those that leave, at some point down the road, we get a call from them that says, I want to come back, I want to try again. And research indicates that the more often you try, the more likely you are to be successful. So we all say, yeah, okay, come on back.
Now, like the high school kids that, I mean, you read about it in newspapers or on, you know, social media, the high school kids whose parents spend all of their money getting their kid into treatment and they come back and they same thing happens again. It's because they're not ready, I'm assuming. I mean, it seems like these kids have everything. Affluent families. Why doesn't treatment work, I guess, for them?
Well, it's a chronic disease. It's like, you know, I go into the hospital, I have a heart attack, and I get out and I'm feeling pretty good. If I have another heart attack, if I go back to the hospital, they're not going to say, you were just here last week for a heart attack. Why are you back here again? No, you can't come in until you're ready to stop having these heart attacks. Now, I'm over-exaggerating, I know. But it's similar. You know, we have this belief system that if somebody goes into treatment, they get fixed. It's done. Come on out. You're good. You're fine. And then you have people that relapse. Well, this is a relapsing disease. I say to folks that basically treatment gives you about a half a step on your disease process, because it is right there, right behind you. And if you don't look at it, you don't take it into seriously, it will come back and it will grab you and it will kill you. Because it is a terminal disease process. And unfortunately, you get people, they come out of treatment and they go back and they try to use again, their tolerance has dropped down. They go ahead and they try to use, and it cuts off their heart rate and their respiration, and they die. See that? People getting out of treatment or getting out of jail happens frequently. But, you know, it's like get that kid, that person back into treatment. And so often with those families, they just can't get their head wrapped around it. Because, again, addiction only happens to bad people, and heroin and opiate addiction only happens to inner city people. It doesn't happen to people that we know. Let me pick on Kelsey. I had Kelsey come up, and she requested, and I was delighted to have her come and sit in at our clinic for a day. And she had an opportunity to sit and talk with one of the patients. And you shared some pretty, I think, powerful insights. What's your insight just from the day that you spent talking to these folks and being there? She didn't know I was going to do this, by the way.
It gave a much more human
yeah.
feel to it. Because, like, I mean, around here, I haven't had much personal experience with any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so at first being there was a little bit scary, but, like, I sat in on the group session, and people were just having, like, casual discussions about life and things that I think anyone could relate to, because it's just...
Because people are people.
Because, I mean, they're just normal people who had slip-ups in their life that turned into something horrible, but they're all very willing to talk about everything, and they were open. And the person that I spoke with one-on-one, like, she told me everything that had happened to her, and she wasn't, I mean, while she was obviously not happy with some of the choices she made, she was just very open about her past and how it started as just a little thing that turned, that spiraled out of control, and it made it much more human and relatable almost.
Okay.
And so that was a neat experience.
Yeah. I think that's key. It puts a human face on a tragedy. And so much of this is intergenerational. I had one woman say to her that quality family time in her family was her brother and her sitting down with her mom and dad doing lines of cocaine in the kitchen. And you think to yourself, oh, you got to be kidding. No. We got another guy that's just struggling. But he's been struggling for now a year and 3 or 4 months. And his dad first got him high on marijuana at the age of 6. Can you imagine smoking marijuana with your 6-year-old? I mean, that's not something. Now, and his life has just been crazy. You know, what type of future? Well, excellent question. Huge amount. Because it rewires the brain, but where that kicks in is if you throw the switch. In other words, if you put substances back into your brain. Now, a way of thinking about this is that how many of us have ever ridden a bike? Probably most of us. When did we start learning to ride a bike? Maybe 6 years old, 5, 6, 7. 10 in there. How well did it go for you when you started riding a bike? Well, for me, not well. You know, I'd get in the backyard, we had a hill, I'd try to go down and I'd crash. I'd get really mad and I'd jump up and down on the bike. My mom and dad would look out the window and laugh at their whacked kid jumping on the bike in the backyard. But once I learned to ride, it got wired into my brain. I'm pretty sure that, you know, if there's a bike outside, I could probably get on it and ride it, even though I haven't ridden a bike in about 15 years. That memory, that muscle memory, doesn't go away. So when you rewire your brain, that pathway in that reward system, that hijack system, it remains in place. Now, if you stop the substance use and you start to regain your mind and your emotion and your body function, and you rebuild, that's what recovery is. That's what people say. It's a very simple program. Just don't use. That's the hardest thing of all. Because people are always saying, well, you can do just one. You can just drink one or two. You can, you know, if you've got a problem with opiates, well, you know, you don't have a problem with marijuana, so you can continue to smoke marijuana. That's all that rabbit hole stuff, you know. So how do you recover? You take the courage to make the longest journey any of us will make, and that's the 18 inches between the head and the heart. That journey, that honesty. And if you look at, and some of you may be familiar with what they call the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, or Narcotics Anonymous, or Overeaters Anonymous, or Emotions Anonymous, or Gamblers Anonymous, it's all the same 12 steps. And it starts in the very beginning by saying, my life is unmanageable. It is crazy. I can't deal with this anymore. Then you reestablish your link with your higher power, with God. made a decision to turn my will and life over to God as I understand them. And you start to rebuild, you start to go down that list, and what are you rebuilding? First, you're rebuilding your relationship with God. Then the fourth and fifth step of those 12 steps, you rebuild your relationships with other people. Admitted to myself, to God, and to one other person, the exact natures of them. You're starting to rebuild those relationships. You make amends insofar as possible. You know, all of those things, all the relationships, the key relationships that are destroyed, and in my opinion there are four, God, self, family, and other people, those are the ones that are destroyed. The 12 steps all begin to rebuild those. And it is in relationship, it comes back to Steve, how can a church like this or a family or a community, you rebuild the relationships. Because let's face it, for most of us, when we're in the most pain is when we're the most lonely, right? When we are cut off from other people, when we have no one to talk to, no one to turn to about the pain and the struggle that we're in. We feel alienated from God, alienated from our family and from other people and from our very self. Sometimes that happens as a result of our choice or the pain or the struggle that we're in. For people that are addicts, that is a direct result of their addiction to their substance. Because it breaks all those. Your substance becomes your God. Your substance becomes your family. Your substance becomes your best friend. Your substance takes your very soul. And you will seek that over everything else. That's why you turn your back on your family, you turn your back on your friends, you lose your employment, you lose your very health, you know, and the dominoes just continue to fall. Because none of those ultimately matter. Your drug is the only thing that matters. And once you stop, it's very simple, stop the substance use. And then actively work. There's a whole process called a dry drunk. There are people that maybe they don't use anymore, but they continue to be a rotten SOB. That's because they didn't make those moves emotionally, intellectually, morally. We talked today in the sermon about the heart being the fullness of human life. Harden not your heart. Man, if there's anything that hardens a heart, it's addiction. It's addiction. I used to hear all the time that love was the great healer. I think pain is the great healer. Because it's like, doc, it hurts when I do this. Okay, well then don't do it. Stop it. You know, how do I do that? Well, with addiction you start to get help. Well, we're only 45 minutes over time.
Just one last quick point. I think maybe one of the challenges we would deal with in a community like this is it's an awful lot harder to be anonymous. And as opposed to being in the city, it's easy to know there's a clinic at, you know, at a few blocks away. I can go in there. Most people won't know who I am. But in an area like this, everybody knows your business. And I can certainly see where the stigma or the shame, it may be a lot harder to confront and just force you to continue to withdraw within the addiction as opposed to trying to confront it. Just having that fear of judgment that may come upon you from
a community. Well, Steve makes an excellent point. If you talk about, he used the word stigma. If I have heart disease or if I have cancer, I have no problem going to my physician and going to the office and sitting in the waiting room and saying hello to my neighbors and going and getting help and getting my medication, going to the hospital or whatever. But if I'm an addict or an alcoholic, I don't want anyone seeing me going into the mental health center or being at the hospital or being at the clinic or getting help. And it's all because of stigma. All because we fundamentally think that if you have heart disease or cancer, well, you didn't choose that. Okay, you didn't want that. But if you're an addict, well, that was your choice. You did that to yourself. And there's all kinds of stuff that go with it as well. But it's like, well, you might choose to drink, but you didn't choose your body's reaction.
Are there facts out as to how many are driving with these drugs in their body? Because it used to be, it was like 1 in 10, you were facing, out of 10 cars, you were facing someone driving drunk. Are there any facts about this? Because we live along a main highway, and in the mowing season, we're finding needles in our yard that have been thrown out. And I was thinking someone told me that they could actually use their seatbelt while they're driving to shoot up.
Oh, is it tourniquet that make the vein pop? Yeah. You know, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but I know this just anecdotally, I'm seeing it a lot more in terms of people in the DUI program, because the DUI program that we run, that's just for people that are under an OBI in Ohio, under the influence or operating a vehicle impaired. And they don't make a judgment on whatever the substance was. Might be alcohol, might be marijuana, could be opiate medications or whatever. So they don't make that kind of a judgment distinction. But, you know, if I'm out driving after 11 on a Friday or Saturday night.
Pretty obvious.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's like, why are you out that late? You know, the cars out driving that time of night on a weekend are going to be crazy. And, I mean, what you're saying is, yeah, people drive around the country and get high because they're just driving.
Because I know we reported to the sheriff in case, you know, you don't know what's going on in that area. And then in a few days' paper later, it was the next 10,000 block from us that they found drug paraphernalia in their yard.
Yeah.
So you know they're doing it going down the highway.
Oh, yeah. And that's where, when I said that I'm not necessarily a fan of legalization of recreational marijuana, is we don't necessarily want to have more people out getting high in the roads, in my opinion.
No.
And if it's legal, people will do it. I mean, people are going to do it anyway, but they'll be a little bit more discreet than. And I haven't heard yet about Washington or Colorado, what their numbers are.
I don't know, but his sister and her husband have a cabin in Colorado, and they're there usually about 6 months out of the spring and summer. And they said, we do not want it. It is crazy the way the people are laying on the streets and begging for money. And their grooming is terrible.
Sleeping under the wire dogs.
It's ridiculous. They said, do not vote for it. They're living it when they're out there.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the numbers. Anybody else? Any thoughts, comments, corrections?
Yeah. The people that have sold drugs, I know, I think it was about a month ago, they actually run it down as to who sold to that person. I can't remember now, it was different or rare, that died.
Mm-hmm.
Will they hold these people responsible?
Yeah.
I would hope, because maybe that will help to stop the people that are selling, that they know they're going to be put away forever, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, they're prosecuting more and more folks that, you know, are the dealers. But, you know, a lot of the people that we would read about or see about in the paper, or the dealers, they're really the small-time folks. You know, the people that are making the big money are higher up the food chain.
But it doesn't matter if they're making a penny or millions. If they're killing somebody,
yep.
I think it needs stopped.
Yep, I agree. Well, you know, bottom line is we just can't take it for granted. We've got to be informed and realize that it's not just an inner city problem, that it's Fostoria and it's Bettsville and it's Fremont and it's Tiffin. And, you know, one of the easy steps to take is go home and look in the medicine cabinet. You've got prescription medications in there that you don't need. You know, and you think, well, no one will ever get that.
So where should, like he asked, turn them in now? If we had a sheriff that was taking them, who can you trust?
Yeah. Well, and that's,
are you better off,
you know, that's
them in your backyard? Or
yeah. I mean that's where the sheriff got in trouble, right?
Mm-hmm.
He got them with those turn-in programs.
We take our citizen to the county sheriff's office. They have a place to drop them in.
But he was going around evidently and getting them. from the sheriff's office. Sorry.
Well, and in support of law enforcement, I would say that probably he is the minority, not the majority, because you got like Sheriff John Thorpe or
Bill Eckleberry's.
I mean, there's all kinds of people around that are really doing what they need to do to address this. But I think that one of the first steps, and I'm honored to be here with you, is to be able to take some time just to talk about this issue as a community and open our eyes to it a little bit more.
I'm not sure what anyone thinks of this, and I'm not, but I do know one of those things on that board, trauma, and we can't help people with trauma and make a difference there. And what's the number one, what's a big, big problem with trauma in this city? Maybe we could make a difference there. I don't know. I don't want to push my personal things on anyone else, but if I could make a proposal or education to present some information, maybe that's something that we feel like we could do as a
Well, and the important thing is to understand that this is a very complex issue. It's not just only addiction. Because how did you get, well, maybe you had a chronic pain issue that led to addiction, that led to some kind of a mental health issue, that when you were high, you ended up experiencing trauma. Now, how do we worm back through all of those? You know, how do we address that in a comprehensive nature that comes back to, how do we treat people? Well, you got to treat the whole package. People is people. Thank you all.